So we're really pleased this evening to have Professor William Kohlbrenner with us once again. Professor Kohlbrenner is one of the leading thinkers in traditional Judaism today. He writes with elegance, with humor, with gravitas, and he displays his knowledge and erudition in everything he writes. He's the author of Open-Minded Torah, which is this book here, of Irony, Fundamentalism, and Love. He's a professor of English literature at Bar-Ilan University, an internationally renowned scholar of Renaissance literature. He also writes a regular, really wonderful column for the Washington Post's On Faith, A Letter from Israel, and he's now publishing widely in other journals, including The Forward, Jewish Week, and other major publications. We're delighted to have him here. Won't you please welcome Professor William Kohlbrenner.
Thank you. I'm really thrilled to be here today. Just give me a moment to collect myself. You kind of caught me in the middle over here. We were meant to have handouts, but there's nothing like improvisation and taking risks. I want to first express my gratitude to the Melamets for inviting me, especially Elliot. And I think one of the things that I've learned from Torah in Motion in the past when I've been here, and also from my correspondences with Elliot, is there's a certain virtue of taking risks. And I'm wondering tonight about what it means to take risk within a Jewish framework of Jewish observance, a framework of Jewish learning. What's the title of my talk tonight, Elliot? Beyond conformity. Can we use such a term? Can we use a terminology of beyond conformity in this framework? I want to start tonight by telling you about my wife's vacation. Now, I know that sounds exciting. My wife went to visit her parents in Minnesota, which is actually not as cold as it was here today in Toronto. And I was left to take care of my kids. So I'm preparing for my class. I teach English literature at Bar-Ilan. I think we were doing Sidney's Defense of Poetry or something like that. And I'm sitting at my kitchen table preparing for class. Normally, I don't sit at my kitchen table preparing for class. I have an office, but I'm minding the controlled chaos of the house. At home were my three girls, who were 15, 12, and 10, maybe a little younger, and two boys, about 8 and 6. The girls are taking a ballet chug, let's say like a ballet after-school activity. And they're very adorable, just speaking personally. They're very adorable. And I noticed out of the corner of my eye, they had some horrible Jewish music playing. I hope I'm not offending anybody's sensibilities. And they were doing their various, any ballet experts here? Pliés, and what are the other things they do? Oh, thank you. They're not that sophisticated. And spagats. So I'm looking out of the corner of my eye, and being as adorable as they were, I indulged myself a little, and instead of preparing for Renaissance literature the following day, I watched them. And as I watch them, I see that my 8-year-old's spagat becomes slightly more extended, and my 10-year-old's plié becomes slightly more theatrical. And my 14-year-old's, you mentioned one of them, whatever she was doing, became a little bit more performative. And I realized at that moment that I had caught them in the act. And by catching them in the act, I had changed their activity from one thing into another. That is, they had been dancing, and when they saw me seeing them, they started to perform. And I thought about that as a kind of moment that might tell us a little bit about education. I wonder, what happened at that time? What happened when they saw me seeing them? I feel I'm obliged to tell you that I'm having just such a wonderful time in Toronto, and my stay in Toronto really began, I felt, when I got on the LL flight from Tel Aviv to Toronto. And I noted to one of the flight staff that the plane trip was utterly different than my experience normally when I fly from Tel Aviv to New York. And what was the difference about it? That there were no Israelis or New Yorkers on the plane. And it was much more civilized and reserved. Now, me myself being both an Israeli and a New Yorker, I'm not quite so reserved. And I would just ask you to overcome your normal civilized reserve, not on the plane if you're on my flight on the way back, but tonight, and to kind of help me out here, I'm really serious in asking this question. What changed in their seeing me seeing them? I'm sure you've had similar experiences with your kids, maybe with friends. How did that activity become different? My girls are not that competitive. It wasn't really about their relationship to each other. Right. So they were no longer playing, but they were performing. Is there a difference between the two? They were no longer playing, but they were performing. Chazal say, our rabbis say, the sages say, a person is known through three things. Bakoso, bakiso, bakaso. By his cup, I guess how much he drinks. By his pocket, how much he gives. And there's an alliteration in Hebrew. And his anger. Va'amrile, af b'schoko. And some say even in his laughter, or even in his play. A person is distinguished through the way they play. So I'm wondering, I didn't know this. In fact, in a discussion I had with Rabbi Sachs, we were talking about the chief rabbi a moment ago in his house, he said that concept of play is foreign to Judaism. Yet here, Chazal do mention that play is a way in which people identify themselves. So I'm wondering, is there a difference between play and performance? My girls had been playing, and they began to perform. So one aspect is the inhibition of spontaneity. They seem to be getting a kind of pleasure for performing for me, but play has that aspect of the spontaneous. Yeah. Maybe we could refine that and say that you're not self-conscious. I mean, because they were conscious, but they weren't self-conscious. And what happens in performance? Right. I'm wondering about, as you express it, I'm wondering about that tension or that opposition in religious life. Is there a place for play, or is there a place for performance? Dr. Malamet, Leah. Yeah. Play is about extending reality. Meaning?
Meaning that when a child plays,
Oh, that's very interesting. And hopefully, Dr. Malamet says, when adults play, is there still a room for adults to play, or are we stuck with performance? There was a British psychotherapist of the 1930s, Marion Milner, and in a book which she titles On Not Being Able to Paint, she describes her therapeutic practice with very young children, 2, 3, and 4-year-olds. Part of that therapeutic practice, as she describes it, was to ask children to draw, or what we would call to doodle. And she noticed a very strange propensity in certain kinds of children. I'll read for you the activity as she describes it. It seemed almost as if at these moments, at a certain point in this drawing or doodling of these children, one could not bear the chaos and uncertainty about what was emerging long enough, as if one had to turn the scribble into something recognizably whole, when in fact the thought or mood seeking expression had not yet reached that stage. The scribble suddenly was arrested, in her terms, turned into something recognizably whole, when in fact the thought or mood seeking expression had not yet reached that stage. What happened? Kids doodling. What does she do? Or what does she stop doing? She stops being spontaneous, and she, in Milner's terms, prematurely turns it into something whole. Why would a child do that? So that same sense of being seen, and perhaps it's also internalizing expectations, created this false conclusion. The doodle turns into something finished. I mean, wouldn't we applaud that? Isn't that something with a child which we would encourage? It was a doodle. It's now a house or a doll. I mean, she's dealing with very young children, and that might be a key to why it, for her it was problematic. What did the children give up in producing a finished image? Spontaneity and process. So that process became arrested by the need again for performance. Again, I ask you, how important is play? How important is performance in Jewish life? For Milner, looking at these young children, it becomes a sign of a certain kind of lack or a problem, an indication of a problem, what she calls a false certainty. And she goes further and says, it shows a kind of compulsive and deceptive need to please. A later British psychoanalyst named Adam Phillips, following in Milner's tradition, writes as follows. He's not talking about little children. He's talking about kids or young people who are studying for psychology degrees. In the first stage, they learn what is being taught about psychology just as they learn about other things. The first stage of learning can be called, in Freud's language, identification or acculturation. The first stage of learning is identification or acculturation. The student becomes somebody like, again, the student becomes like somebody who knows these things. The student becomes somebody who is like someone who knows these things. Is that a compliment? Why not? I mean, it's... Just maybe like the child drawing, becoming someone who looks like they know certain things. I want to become competent. I want to give the image of being competent. In Winnicott's language, another psychotherapist, it would be called compliance. The child fits in with the teacher's need to teach, and by implication, with the culture's demand that these are the things that one learns, and this is the way one learns them. At this stage, competence is a kind of imitation. So Phillips mentions a couple of things. Acculturation, identification, competence. Are these important parts of the educational process? Being like someone who knows certain things? I don't know what the Toronto school systems are like, but sometimes I feel that my own children's education is based upon being someone who looks like they know certain things. It's just giving competence. You go, so it looks like, Baruch Hashem, you have much better school systems than we do. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's probably not
Ah, right.
The problem is that it never grabbed
your conscience. So, and until it does mention, this is the first stage of education. But when that becomes the end point of education, all there is this performance. Again, I wonder, like, is there a role for the performative in Jewish life? In my neighborhood in Jerusalem, I live in Bayit Vegan, if any of you have visited or plan to visit, I have some friends or acquaintances who are kind of like Torah personalities. They perform their Yiddishkeit, their Judaism, in a very public way. And my attitude over the years has become greater and greater skepticism. Why would one have skepticism or cynicism in relationship to such a person? Where is that authentic person? Where is the process? I mean, I think, as Eliot is pointing out, there's a little bit of a tension or dialectic with a child in one's own household. One has to give in some sense, to a kind of performance. One is performing adulthood, Jewish commitment, faith, learning. But when it becomes an end in itself, it becomes problematic. So, yes? The reality as opposed to perception. Help me out here with what you mean.
So in Judaism, it's not what we look like, but what we are inside, in the same way that with education, it's not about what someone looks like, or what somebody appears to know, what they're actually, what they actually know, and what they're actually learning.
Although, so Milner and Winnicott and Phillips show again and again in educational processes that that notion of process, of authenticity, is betrayed. I mean, I wonder, are there ways, in other ways in our culture, in which performance dominates? I saw something on the internet. It was a Rosh Hashanah card or New Year's card. May your life be as exciting and adventurous as your Facebook page claims it to be, right? Meaning, we're all the time, we're in the performance business. Everybody who's on Twitter or Facebook is marketing their self-image. If they're not selling a book, where's my book? Buy my book. They're just selling themselves. They're selling that image of themselves. I had a former teacher, and when we went on field trips, he forbade us from bringing our cameras. I mean, tell a 15-year-old Jewish high school girl that she can't bring a camera on her field trip. What's the point? Why would you go? I mean, why do the girls bring the girls and the boys bring the cameras on field trips? Because the whole thing is about taking the pictures, so when you come back, you can show your friends about what you experienced. But in fact, you really didn't experience anything because it was all mediated by the photograph. So the teacher was saying, go without the camera. Why? You might actually experience it beyond your anticipation of the mediated image. Yes, you had a comment.
I sympathize with that.
Okay, but you're unsympathetic to something else, I'm gathering.
I don't take cameras for that very reason.
Okay.
But then I'm false too.
Blame it on your wife. If there's any inauthenticity in our household, it's my wife's fault. Yeah. No, I'm not. So fine. I mean, and I did ask: is there a relationship between play and performance?
Okay.
And there even may be something more to be said. Oscar Wilde said famously, put on a mask and show me who you are. Perform and show me who you are. That's also a kind of Shakespearean insight. That's not a direction I want to go into at the moment. But yeah, I think there's always a guard against that kind of cynicism. One more comment and then we'll go on. Yeah?
I have heard, I have to say, numerous things from Mary's rebuttal. I mean, the reason why
Okay.
I mean, then there would just be the other side of this emphasis on externals, maybe, which doesn't pull the internal along with it. So I'm wondering again about the role of play. I will quote yet another psychotherapist. We will get to some explicitly Jewish content in a moment. A psychotherapist named Christopher Ballas, and he writes as follows. He talks about the virtue of playing. Einstein, he says, wrote of his rather vague play with the elements, a combinatory play that allows for the possibility of new kinds of connections. Ballas talks about the role of play, not only, as we'll see, in expected places, literary creation, artistic creation, but also among scientists. Another, I think, physicist, Poincaré, am I pronouncing his name properly for those who know? Pardon? Poincaré, thank you. He wrote at the moments before his great breakthroughs, I did not know. This idea of not knowing and being in a place where playing, as in Einstein's case, combining different elements, became the prerequisite for a new discovery. Playing, putting things together that normally don't seem to belong. That's what informs, as Ballas writes, novelty, innovation. Move to a more perhaps obvious literary realm. The poet and essayist T.S. Eliot, in a well-known essay from the 1920s, called Metaphysical Poets, he writes as follows. When a poet's mind is perfectly equipped for its work, it is constantly amalgamating disparate experiences, putting together different things. The ordinary man's experience is chaotic, irregular, fragmentary. The latter falls in love, or reads Spinoza, and these two experiences have nothing to do with each other. Of course, we can see their relationship, right? Or with the noise of the typewriter, or the smell of cooking. Eliot's a poet, even as he's writing an essay. In the mind of the poet, these experiences are always forming new wholes. What's the relationship between reading Spinoza and the sound of a typewriter? For the poet, being able to put these things together allows for innovation. What would be our response to somebody like Eliot who said there's a connection between Spinoza and the smell of cooking? Or of the great 17th century poet John Donne, who says, maybe some of you know this, there's a relationship between lovers and compasses? What would a rational person say? A rational person might say, you're crazy. These things don't belong. As the 18th century literary critic said of John Donne, it's the most heterogeneous ideas, different things, yoked by violence together. These things don't belong. Yet the poet and the scientist, at the moment of their innovation, confess, I didn't know. And when I don't know, I play. I combine things together that normally don't seem to go together. What is the precondition of play? Pardon? Inhibition? To be uninhibited. Yeah, I was going to think maybe like more rhetorically. Yeah. Letting go. And using one's imagination. And not feeling the pressure. I think we have to come back to this. Not feeling the pressure of expectation. Of Abba's glance at my daughter's dancing. The pressure of expectation, what Phillips calls compliance or identification or acculturation, makes play impossible. Yeah, Leah. Right. All is possible. While on the other hand, that expectation, and we can see it in a scientific context, the ways in which, let's say, past paradigms, past models, they dominate. Or in a theological context, or in a cultural context, or an educational context. And in my culture, my children are always telling me, what is mikubal? You know what that means in Hebrew? What's accepted? And very often, my 16-year-old daughter will shake her head at me and say, Abba, don't you know Zalom Kubal? Right? Certain things are not allowed. One of my daughters just got married and engaged, and there was a whole kind of sociological ritual that happened afterwards, the vase of flowers, the aftershave, the shas, the watch. I said, is there any room for innovation? And, you know, my daughter looked at me and she said, Abba, don't you know what it means to get married? I said, well, you know, I did it once myself. We did it a little bit differently. So the question really is how expectations make spontaneity or play difficult. Balas writes again, I think of personality. I like this idiom. I think of personality as an erotic aesthetics. Personality as an erotic aesthetics. An intelligence of form that desires to come into existence. The dissemination of our personality suggests principles of creativity, which we may follow what I call an eros of form. An eros of form, the development of a personal, it's a little bit of a pun, idiom. And Balas is being playful himself. An eros of form, a personal idiom. What does he mean when he says a personal idiom? A sense that everybody has their own language and everybody has their own voice. What are the voices that we hear in our lives that are not our own, that are telling us or militating against the realization of that voice? A personal idiom, and Balas connects it to desire because he wants to make it the most intrinsic thing. Of course, there are public languages, languages of competence and acculturation and identification. But for this psychoanalytic perspective, the personal idiom is what is authentic about our own voice. And if you ever have this experience when you're writing or speaking, and suddenly you hear yourself, sometimes it's a great revelation. The extent to which it's a great revelation may be also the extent to which there are other expectations that are making that voice difficult to hear. So let's move a little bit, if we can, from a psychoanalytic framework to more of a cosmological framework. And that cosmology will include stories in the Talmud which represent the founding of the temple in Jerusalem. And in particular, David's role in that founding. So again, I'll relate to you a couple of different stories. Like almost every story that the sages tell, it gets told more than once. And we'll try to pay attention to a couple of different of these tellings. When David began to dig the foundation of the temple, he dug 15 cubits and did not reach the deep. David is digging the foundations. Finally, he found one potsherd and sought to lift it up. Gets to the bottom, he finds a shard. The potsherd said to him, you may not lift me. David replied, and why not? And it replied, because it is I who am restraining the deep. David said, and for how long have you been here? The potsherd replied, since the Almighty proclaimed on Har Sinai, Ani Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord your God. How long has the shard been there, restraining the deep? Since the moment of the giving of the Torah in Har Sinai, I am the Lord your God. At that moment, the earth trembled and began to sink, and I was placed here to restrain the deep. So God declares his law on Mount Sinai, and that simultaneously holds down the forces of the deep. So this story, in some sense, is about the relationship between law and desire. The deep representing these sources of desire or these energies, these primal forces. What holds them down? Ani Hashem Elokecha. What does David do? And it's interesting because we learn not only about cosmology, but really David is a figure who represents maybe the first person who explores in our tradition the vast resources of the interior self. David nevertheless did not listen to it. As soon as he lifted it up, the waters of the deep rose and sought to inundate the world. Strange thing that David does. The shard says, I'm holding down the deep. What does he do? Lifts it up. Why? Why would he list it? These are these primal forces that seek to inundate the world. Isn't it better to restrain them? Isn't it better to hold them down? It's here David is taking the role, strangely, against the divine. Why does he lift it up? Okay. So, he's building a temple. He wants to provide a firm foundation. These forces that he's releasing threaten to overcome not only the world, but the temple that he's going to build. I'm sorry, what was your comment? Okay. He was a man of primal forces. So in lifting up the shard, David says, I want access to those forces. I need those forces. And again, it's not only cosmological, it might be personal as well. David relates to the part of himself that says these sources, that they threaten to inundate the world. The forces of subjectivity, and others have written about this extensively, Rav Soloveitchik, threaten to overwhelm the world. And Rav Soloveitchik brings these stories in a very different way. He emphasizes the importance of the law holding these forces down. But David in the story releases them. Yeah.
I'm thinking also, just from the narrative point of view, I was putting the text together.
Yeah.
Of an analogous source where it's all talk about the impulse to suppress Ariyot in the bottle and realize that the life will cease, that people will not reproduce.
Here's another rendition of the same story, which I think will emphasize Eliot's point. Rav Chisda said, it's the same story, but told slightly differently. What did David have in mind when composing his 15 songs of ascent, the Shir HaMalot? Rav Yochanan said, when David dug the pits of water, the pits, waters of the deep welled up and were going to flood the world. David sang the 15 songs of ascent, Shir HaMalot, and brought the water back down. The Talmud replies, if that were the case, they shouldn't have been called Shir HaMalot, they should have been called Shir HaYeridot, or Shir Songs of Descent. Since you call the matter to mind, this is in fact what has been said about it. When David dug the pits, the waters of the deep welled up and were going to flood the world. David wrote the divine name on a piece of pottery and tossed it into the deep. David has a very different role in this story. What is he doing here? He's writing God's name on a shard and tossed it into the deep. And the water subsided by 16 cubits. When David saw how much the water had subsided, he said, the nearer it is, the more it will water the earth. Thereupon he sang 15 songs of ascent, so the waters of the deep came back up by 15 cubits, and that now they remain a cubit below. In this story, David first throws the shard down. Why? Why? I guess the fear of these energies. But when they're too far down, what's problematic when they're too far down? They are the source of life. So in this interesting reconciliation of the story, David sings the song of ascent so they come up, but not too far. Meaning the sources of life, where these well springs of water have to be near enough to give life, but far away enough not to inundate the world. These forces, internal forces and cosmological forces, give life to the world. Another story along a similar line, in which there's the same emphasis on the forces within. A philosopher once said to Rabban Gamliel, when the Gemara refers to a philosopher, what kind of philosopher are we thinking about? Yeah, well, might be by definition. Probably an Aristotelian philosopher, and we'll see in a minute what that will mean.
A philosopher once said to Rabban Gamliel, "Your God is a great artist, but he found good materials which helped him. Chaos, the void, the deep, and wind, ruach, water and darkness." What's Aristotelian about this philosophical perspective? Your God is a great artist, but he found good materials which helped him. What's his perspective on, let's say, creation? Pardon? Permanent. Well, we believe in yesh miayin, ex nihilo creation, something from nothing. What is this philosopher saying? Yesh miyesh, what does that mean? What does yesh miyesh mean? Something from something. I mean, your God is great, but he had a lot of stuff he had in his toolbox, or not in his toolbox, it was already available to him. Chaos, the void, the deep, the wind, water, and darkness. I mean, he didn't create those things. Aristotle believed in the eternity of matter. Matter is co-eternal or with the divine. So Rabban Gamliel turns to this philosopher and says, "Let the spirit or ruach of that person be blasted. For scripture affirms that all of these things were created. With regard to chaos and the void, it is written, 'I make peace and create evil.' That's from Isaiah. And with regard to the wind, or ruach, it is written, 'He forms the mountains and creates the wind.' With regard to the deep, it is written, 'Out of nothing, I carved out the deep.' What are all these proof texts coming to suggest? God made everything. What's the curse that Rabban Gamliel gives to the philosopher? Let the spirit or ruach of that person be blasted. It's almost like a performative utterance. It's almost something that's true in its very saying. Let the ruach of that person be blasted. Why is he cursed, the philosopher? It's interesting that the same word that appears in the proof text, the wind that God created, is used in the curse. Let the spirit or wind or ruach of spirit of that person be blasted. Why is he blasted? Why is he cursed? Because he doesn't know the forces within him. He doesn't know that the force within him, the ruach within him, is of divine origin. The philosopher doesn't know the spirit that's inside of him. And Rabban Gamliel is just pointing that out to him. Not only is the universe not material and present, but your body is also a divine creation, and you don't know that. And therefore, he's blasted. He's not aware, again, of the forces within, which begs the question. The stories about the temple, with those forces or waters, where do they come from? I mean, it's almost, we can almost read them in the way I read them. It's almost like a Manichaean world where there's good and evil, and David is the source of good when he holds them down, and evil threatens to overflow the world. But that's not quite it, is it? Where do these waters or sources come from? What is their origin? They're also divine. They're also divine. I mean, you pointed out he's building the temple. So the question is, what is the role of these forces in divine service? Divine service is not only about the law. Divine service is also about these energies. This is the place the temple stands. What do you do with those forces? Some would say, you better push them all the way down. What do the stories tell us? They're part of divine service. These forces, these energies, are also part of a religious life. So I want to think now, since we've spoken about these energies, about the relationship between desire and learning, desire and knowledge. Sometimes, in a Greek context, even in a Jewish context, these things are seen as separate. When we talk about knowledge, we think, who is a wise person? What defines a wise person? What would you say? Akiva, what would you say? What defines a wise person? Do our sages relate to this question? Oh, so we already know the answer. What's the question? So Ben Zoma asks, he says, Eizehu chacham, who is a wise person? So before you already know the answer, or you know the sage's answer, what would be our inclination? Who is a wise person? Right, but I want to go before it. I mean, Chazal are never telling us something that would be obvious. I mean, it's obvious to us now because we're immersed in the tradition, I suppose. But even, I think sometimes their answers are maybe even counterintuitive to what we would expect. How would we define what wisdom is? Yes, you're already suggesting something kind of... Pardon? So you might even think of it as quantitative, meaning some guy who has like the entire, I don't know if you have this database, this DBS Torah library in their head, you would say he's very wise. No? Yeah, Leah. Oh, okay. We know that the sages very often are interested in the parameters of something. I want to measure it. So what is the measure of wisdom? Yeah. Okay. Yes, Leah. Uh-huh. Oh, so that's already interesting, and that already presupposes some of our discussion about play. The sages again will give a different answer, but your answer is a little bit hard to quantify or to provide parameters for. How do I know who is a wise person? I might have thought it's somebody who knows a lot of stuff. Right? Would you grant that as a possibility? He knows a lot. Right. As I tell my students, you can become informed through Wikipedia. Right? Your favorite website should be Google, but that's for information and not for knowledge. Right? I think that's kind of parallels what you're suggesting. What is Sage's answer? Person who learns from all people. How is that a measurement? And why is that important? A person who learns from all people. Sounds very modern or even postmodern, doesn't it? Sounds like the sages are very contemporary. Maybe they are in some sense. Yeah, it's a question. I mean, how is that a measure? And why is that a significant that a person learns from all people. Yeah. Uh-huh. Right. Uh-huh. Yeah. That's interesting. So no prejudice would be a precondition for a certain kind of wisdom. The Maharal says that who provides a commentary on this Mishnah. He says, a person who goes and asks everyone is showing his yearning, his desire. The word in Hebrew is mishtokek. He yearns for wisdom. And that yearning for wisdom that you see, that provides an external measure. When he walks around and he runs from one person to another, that is the measure of wisdom. The willingness, and maybe that's a nice explanation of it, to see and to ask other people. A person, the Maharal says, who goes only to one rabbi, and this is interesting because we know there's another mission in Perkei Avos that says the Selech HaRav, but a person who only asks questions of one rabbi, he is more interested not in knowledge, but rather in affiliation. I go to one rabbi. Why? I like his style. I want to wear the hat that he wears and the kind of suit that he wears. Why would I do such things? Pardon? To abandon that inner voice. And that's an interesting question. Why do people abandon their inner voice? I wonder, are there pleasures involved in giving up one's own voice?
There may be. I mean, there may be what we would understand as not exactly healthy pleasures, but the pleasures of abandoning the self in order to affiliate. So a person who asks everybody shows his desire not for affiliation, but for knowledge. Not to be part of one yeshiva or one crowd or one group, but to ask everybody. I just went, I don't know, I don't understand, in Toronto there's also a limud. Have you anybody gone to the limud? I know the malamids have. And there is just this amazing experience of people being in dialogue. And not just saying, I'm only asking people in my group. Some rabbis say you can't go to limud. Why? Because the implication is you can only learn from people who are already like you. But then, if you can only learn from people who already like you, what's the point? Learning presupposes that there's something, a perspective that I don't already know. And when learning is defined as rather just affirming or conforming to my assumptions of what can be known, it's not learning. So being in dialogue with different people presupposes being able to understand that there's something I don't already know. Yeah. Okay. So but maybe they're talking about different things, the Selach HaRav and this Mishnah? I mean, the Selach HaRav I'm not trying to undermine that at all. It may be about behavior. What's the halacha? What advice? But in terms of learning, I mean, there is an emphasis maybe, like we see in other contexts. Sages say, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, about a dispute, emphasizing again multiplicity. These and these are the words of the living God. Aval halacha ve'beis hillel. But the halakha, the law, is like Beit Hillel. Meaning, even though we admire and encourage this cognitive process, still you have to find your own rabbi when you need a question answered. So can we move from maybe the Maharal to John Keats, a letter that he wrote to one of his friends. He writes as follows: Let us not therefore go hurrying about and collecting honeybee-like buzzing here and there and impatiently for a knowledge of what is to be arrived at, but let us open our leaves like a flower and be passive and receptive. Read that again. Let us therefore not go hurrying about and collecting honeybee-like, buzzing here and there impatiently for a knowledge of what is to be arrived at, but let us open our leaves like a flower and be passive and receptive. What's wrong with a honeybee? Buzz, buzz, buzz. Frantic. What does that phrase mean, for a knowledge already arrived at? Uh-huh. Phillips writes in another context, I don't know if you'll appreciate that, this. He says that perversion is knowing what you want. The pervert is the one who knows what's going to give him pleasure beforehand. I need this particular thing. There's a certain kind of fetishism of one thing. I know what I want already. And that's, in a way, a kind of knowledge. Buzz, buzz, buzz. I already know what I want. What's the opposing image? Let us open our leaves like a flower and be passive and receptive. Maharal, for all of his emphasis on running to different rabbis, says as well, be a mikabel. Be somebody who is open. What does that openness assume? As you guys said earlier, no prejudice, no assumptions. I'm willing and ready to learn. How much is the process of saying, I don't know, part of the process of knowledge? Knowledge becomes arrested when it's already assumed that I know.
The poet and sometimes prose writer John Milton writes, "He who says we are to pitch our tent here, that man is very far short of the truth." Using a metaphor from camping. He who says that we are to pitch our tent here, that man declares himself to already be far short of truth. If you say you've arrived at truth, what does that mean? Haraya, this becomes a proof that you're very far short of the truth. The person who says you've arrived, I'm already here, has given up on process. Yes, Leah.
To the various important personalities, like the Abraham Lakota, when he was told to leave his father's house, and also when he went to the Akeda, he's not told the mountain that he's going to be sacrificed in the Ukraine. There's many other examples given, but the thrust of it is that there should not be premature definition. This is actually quite deliberate.
And that resonates, I think, as well with what we started out, those images of the psychoanalyst with the child, to not have premature definition, to not have premature conclusions. Yeah. Yeah, it's not, believe me, it's not the first time. Not even the first time today. Okay. I don't know which makes me feel worse, but go ahead, yeah. Yeah. Where you're going, you're going. Why the modern Orthodox? Yeah. I'm being unjustifiably idealistic because I'm not being attuned to sociological realities, or I'm being unnecessarily idealistic because I'm misrepresenting the way Torah wants us to be. You think it's...
I'm going to take this point one further. The irony of what you're saying is that the skeptic will come along and say, but you're actually talking about a system that clamps down walls everywhere, not sociological walls, intrinsic theological parameters, things that you cannot inquire about, laws that cannot be broken, givens that cannot be broached, values, you know.
There are two points here. One is a sociological point, one is a theological point. So then the question becomes, what is the role of the sources that we've looked at today? Is it my own postmodern sentiment that is kind of wrenching these sources out of their context? I mean, I think here's the question. We have a natural tendency towards celebrating, maybe in this room, difference, allowing for process, allowing for combination, allowing for play, allowing my girls to play, allowing people to put things together in different ways. And yet, our tradition is not open in that sense, not totally open. I wrote a book called Open-Minded Torah. So in a sense, I'm getting a book review. It's not true. The other Dr. Malamba is suggesting the tradition itself is closed. I think. Wait. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where there's the seduction of, let's play. Let's talk about law versus desire.
Right.
Let's do all this. And then, just when you're not looking,
right.
I
think there are a couple of issues that need to be addressed, or not issues. I'm just the first thing that I think about is just like we talked about scientists or poets. We talk about Talmidei Chachamim. Who are the most original Talmidei Chachamim? They're willing to play, meaning that's part of a process. Now, there are all these walls you're suggesting. I mean, we can't really argue with that. I wonder, and maybe this is one of the questions for our generation, is what is the relationship between this idea of process and difference that we celebrate and those walls? Is there such a thing as circumscribed difference? Or does that just become an oxymoron as well? Or does that become a more palatable way, I think, of describing an orthodoxy that does make us comply. Yeah. 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 No, I heard that. I heard that very, very clearly. But I think that's a sociological reality we can protest against. We can protest against. I would just my next free association, and that's one of, I think free association is the Freudian version of play, is Robert Frost, part of the earlier part of the century, wrote that writing in free verse is like playing playing tennis without a net. When you write poetry without rules, Frost said, and he's like a kind of not modern temperament, when you write poems without rules, without a rhyme scheme, it's like playing tennis without a net. Why would he say that? In order to play the poetry game, Frost says, you need rules. Why do you need rules? It's so constraining. Because if you really want to play, you need a game. And without the game, you can't play. Because in order to play the game, and there's sometimes, I suppose, I can see you're not happy with the mushel here, sometimes in order to play, you have to have rules. Why don't you break them? Play with them. Manipulate them. Yeah.
Your discussion reminds me of the antithesis of
the yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yes, Rabbi Kiln. Yeah. Oh, I thought you were going to say astronauts.
Right.
Well, we tend to.
So that
gets back to the dichotomy between compliance and creativity. There may be, as we said earlier, that compliance is a first stage. Why is that the first stage of education? And this is where I think Phillips, as a psychotherapist, is going much too far on the level of process, because he's not interested at all in compliance. Compliance and competence is learning a language. In order to be creative, I need to learn a language. And I believe this deeply about like teaching English literature. In most English literature programs today, people don't have any sense of literary tradition. You learn a little of this, a little of this, a little of that. I went to Columbia, and for some reason I had to take a core curriculum, and then I went on to Oxford, and I learned all of English literary history.
And that ability to see the breadth of a literary tradition, it allows you to know a language and to play. So I think there's a relationship between that sense of being able to incorporate process, but also this sense of competence, not as an end in itself, but as a first step. Because without competence, there's no play, like Frost says. Yeah.
Yeah. It's about saying that you can't define anything without context. You can't have a developer itself unless there's some kind of boundary or structure against which that self can now push.
And maybe defines itself in terms of both similarity and also difference. No, I'm waiting for further.
Yeah. I don't think it's analogous because, in other words, Tor is like you're playing for your life. In other words, you can play with Dickens, and you can play with Shakespeare, and you can play with Sartre. But when we talk about play in the context of a religion that actually imposes rules, and we use the Frost analogy, so A, the Frost is of all poetry. The next thing I go, and I always like that line too. The problem here is who makes the rules? Who gets to change them? Who filters them? And it's not good enough just to say, you know, play is only meaningful in the structure of rules because there's an arbitrariness about it that collapses on itself. So that's the problem. You know, if you short circuit the discussion about creativity by saying, but we need to have rules, you're still going to lead to a secondary discussion about who made the rules. Why are those rules bonded, et cetera? The whole discourse of the last 200 years goes to mind. So it still leads you, you know, back into the quiet mind.
And if we just, I mean, I came today really to talk about play. If we just embrace, so what would a world be in which there is only play? And I think in some sense, in literary traditions as well, these boundaries are always in some sense negotiated. I think the lack of play in our culture means that they have ceased to be negotiated in any kind of productive way.
And what happens in the world when the rules don't work?
If you have dysfunction. But there are different kinds of dysfunction. There's a dysfunction of an authoritarian culture in which there's no play, in which the energies have been pushed away. And there's the dysfunction of a culture in which those energies are welcomed and inundate the world. And I think that's the problem that we're facing. The Chasam Sofer, you know, I think we're all achronim. I don't, you know, I'm not going to disagree with the Chasam Sofer, but right. But we live in our time. We see the necessity for newness. Yeah. I'm sorry, yeah. Let's hear new.
The Chasam Sofer is a perfect example. Yeah. For whom is play desirable or permissible? For individuals, you know, of course, it's part of everyone's intellectual development, whether you're seeking spiritual or intellectual development. It's just a question of, is it appropriate for leaders, whether religious leaders or political leaders, to say, you know, there are no rules, go ahead, do whatever you like. You know, that's from a public position, it's not, or a theological position. You have to pick a theological position that has a social construct that matches it. So,
I mean, we did talk about before about the relationship between, on the one hand, the cognitive and then the policy. But there might be, and I think Dr. Malabit is talking about the ways in which these two may interact one with the other. Yes. Yeah.
That Torah represents life.
Mm.
It's just that the rules aren't as obvious and the imposition of authority isn't there.
Okay. For some people, literature is a very, very serious business. You know? Maybe just one more passage that I had wanted to conclude with. Gemara in Shabbos, Amar Rav Yossi, he says, Rav Yossi says, Yi chelki im ha-meisim b'meitim b'derech mitzvah. Rav Yossi says, I want my chelik to be with those who die on the way to the performance of a mitzvah. It's a strange bracha, right? Let my portion be with those who die on the way to the performance of a mitzvah. It's weird, no? Is he wishing an early death upon himself? Let my portion be with those who die on the way to perform a mitzvah. The Maharal explains that a person who's already done a mitzvah is on a lower level, as it were, than somebody who's in the midst. One who has performed a mitzvah is already done. I'm finished. One who is in process, and he uses the term about cleaving to God, is closer to God by being in process. It's almost process versus stasis. If I'm in process, I'm on a higher level. Does Rav Yossi want his life to be cut off? He wants to live, like everybody else, to 120. But when he's 120, he wants to be, at that point, like my girls were in the hallway or in the living room, to be caught in the act. To be caught in the act of playing and not performing. See, notwithstanding some of the discussion today, I think there is a sense of an internal imperative not to perform and to play. To give in to that sense of, and I don't think play is frivolous. Play as a way of finding our identities again. And I also think in our kind of postmodern, almost post-denominational world, we have more room. We have more room to play. And rules and language games, I think, are a little bit different. That putting ourselves in relationship to a tradition gives us that ability to play. I mean, Poincaré and Einstein didn't come up with their theories in the schoolyard, meaning they were equipped to play properly. Yes, Leah. Yeah. What do they do?
What do they actually do? Yeah. In
no, what instead of playing, what do they do?
They take in very rigid terms. They live in very rigid terms. They're very anxious, they're very fearful, they're actually very frightened of that kind of stupid open space.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what Philip says. Not playing is a form of perversion, a perverse fetishism of what I think, already want, and know. So maybe that's a good place to end or to invite some more questions that you should enjoy and get pleasure from play. Yeah.
In the context of religious life.
Yeah. I think people have used different terms tonight. I think the sense of experimentation, of being willing not to be beholden to one set of ideas. I don't know if you, when you write or when you have conversations, again, there's the moment when you're breaking out of those predictable ways of thinking. And we're all beholden to them, to styles of thought, the way people think in my community, the way people think in my yeshiva, the way people think in my neighborhood. To be able to take the risk. How often do you not go to a certain thought? That's crazy. The greatest thinkers go there. They go to the place that you think is crazy because they trust their instincts. I think it's a kind of Freudian insight as well. And I think it, this idea that there is some kind of connection between associations. It's not just craziness. And the willingness to go there. And I think sociologically, I'm not a policymaker, and I haven't been thinking about some of the issues in the terms that they've been defined tonight, but in terms of being able to discover parts of ourselves, to go with the resources that we have to trust ourselves, when the voices outside of us are telling you, don't do that. There's conservative ways of thinking, and I'm not talking about politics. Yeah.
But just to follow up on that, you have to put the parameters on play. Are we talking about your daughter not giving a shastet, but rather giving a mishita mishnayas, or having a last fling with his haruta? Like, there's a different... I mean, using extremes there is like something that's just a perfunctory...
I want to tell you...
Social
you.
Convention, or like... Or let's try not to keep each other at the same place.
Okay. That was a sociological example. I gave my son-in-law just so you should know, I gave him a squash right.
Okay.
I did not give him a shot.
But should we eat a shrimp salad and not keep Shabbos this week? Just to figure that out.
I think that's what Dr. Mohammed is talking about. And I would insist, though, that we tend to fall into bifurcation where there is either all... And that I've got to, you know, do everything like everybody says, and there are these normative rules, and they're not breakable. Or on the other hand, there's just the free play. And as a Harvard philosopher said, enough is enough. Enough may not be everything, but enough is enough. He's asking us to break out of Western ways of thinking, which say, well, you're either here or here. Play may entail, in some sense, acknowledging restrictions or limitations. We all do. Whether in societies or our households, I mean, I have a conversation regularly with my classmates at Bar-Ilan about censorship, because I teach Milton, and Milton wrote a great tract on censorship, and they're all so horrified to hear that anyone would ever advocate censorship. And some of my students are mothers and fathers, and they have kids. And I say to them, do you have internet in your house? Of course. Do you have an filter in your house? Of course we do. Because we don't let everything always go. There are always implicit kinds of restrictions. Now, whether or not internet filters are resonant or not, there is always some sense, even in the freest culture, of some kinds of limitations. And I think there may be a possibility of playing, maybe by the rules. How those rules are negotiated, I guess that remains an open question. Thank you again for having me. It's always very pleasurable to have such an engaged and polite audience. It's a big departure from my Israeli.